Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session, pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. Court is pleased to welcome members of the government class of Reagan High School in Austin, Texas here today for this session. We have three causes which we will hear oral argument on this morning. In the order in which they will be presented, they are as follows. Citizens National Bank of Denton and the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation as receiver for Citizens National Bank of Denton versus John H. Cockrell, Jr. from Denton County. Crystal D. Duke versus Maryland Casualty Company from Fannin County. And Walmart Stores Incorporated individually and Walmart Stores Incorporated for business as Sam's Wholesale Club versus Sarah and Sam Alexander from Cameron County. In each of these three causes, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The petitioners may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by so advising the marshal of this court. These arguments are being recorded for the convenience of the court. If you would like to listen to a tape of the argument, you may make application with our clerk. The court will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each argument. We're also pleased to welcome Judge Rose Spector from San Antonio here. Yep, there she is. Judge Spector will be joining this court on January the 1st. Court is now ready to hear argument from petitioners in Citizens National Bank versus Cockrell.
May it please the court, Mr. J. Scott Watson will present argument for petitioners. He has reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, I'm Scott Watson of FDIC's appellate litigation staff, and I represent the FDIC as receiver for Citizens National Bank of Denton today. I'd like to thank the court for allowing me to participate in this morning's argument. The Court of Appeals committed reversible error on 2 points of law. In the first, there's no evidence of any probative value that Cockrell filed notice of his security interest within 20 days of delivering possession of the collateral in this case to the Sidnors. And in order to reverse and render, the Court of Appeals adopted a definition of possession that's contrary to well-established case law and the policy under the UCC. If adopted, the Court of Appeals definition would lead to absurd results. Second, the Court of Appeals also erred in assessing exemplary damages against the federal receiver of a failed national bank. That was contrary to an express statute, to Supreme Court precedent as recognized by a recent Fifth Circuit decision, by federal common law, by Texas case law, and also it's contradicted by public policy. First, I'd like to address the Court of Appeals' improper definition of possession under the UCC and the absence of any evidence to support Cockrell's claim to a priority. To briefly review the facts, on May 9, 1985, FDIC's predecessor perfected a security interest in the after-acquired equipment of the Sidnors. On August 1, 1985, Sidnor entered into an agreement with Cockrell, dated August 1st, to purchase Cockrell's business. That purchase occurred on August 1st. We have listed a number of facts in support of that, but the three of the very important ones are that Sidnor began operating the business on August 1st, assumed the lease and took control of the warehouse on August 1st, began operating the business on August 1st, and the security agreement, which is the basis of Cockrell's claim to a priority, was dated August 1st. The evidence offered by Cockrell that he had retained possession is that he retained keys to the Sidnor's warehouse, that he had an office three doors down, and that he had employees on Sidnor's premises while Sidnor's operated the business. In order to gain a priority over the FDIC's security interest, Cockrell had to have filed his notice within 20 days of the Sidnor's possession, and that did not occur. If you'll re-examine pages 14 and 15 of Cockrell's brief, although he argues that there's an abundance of evidence in support, all that he has are the keys being three doors down and having employees on the premises. None of these has probative value that he transferred physical control of the inventory on or after September 17th, which would have been necessary to establish his priority. The appropriate standard under the UCC 9312 is when Cockrell transferred that physical control of the equipment. the Seminole Finance Company case from the Fourth Circuit discusses that standard and explains the rationale behind it. Possession is transferred when the buyer assumes physical control of the goods, and that occurred here on August 1st. The UCC is intended to inject certainty into commercial transactions. It's intended to give notice to everyone of the commercial transactions that are occurring. That certainty cannot exist here if the seller, by retaining some tie to the equipment in some way, may delay his filing. It gives the seller the power to suspend the requirement that he file upon the transfer of possession. And others with a security interest, as the FDIC here, must be protected from sellers who can otherwise avoid 9312's requirements. In addition to that finance company case, the Mark Products case in Texas, while not specifically addressing the possession requirement, makes it clear that notice to the world that transfer of possession has occurred is the operative element, and that 9312 will not allow a party upon transferring physical control to later delay the filing indefinitely. The absurd results that could occur if this court should adopt the Court of Appeals definition of possession are obvious. First of all, any party that had sold equipment that retained some sort of consultant's role in the operation of the equipment, whether by contract or informally, could delay indefinitely ever filing a notice under 9312. Moreover, the world would be safe to assume that the party that exercised physical control was in possession of those goods, and the party that had retained some tie, in this case retaining keys and having an office near the warehouse operated by the new business, would later be able to claim that it had some possessory interest in the goods. In this case, it's also possible to imagine that if keys were retained by janitors, and janitors had the opportunity to enter, and that exclusive control weren't retained by the new purchasers of the equipment, that somehow they'd have less than a possessory interest under 9312. That can't be the intent behind the UCC. If the Court of Appeals, however, should determine that, if this Court, I should say, should determine that the Court of Appeals was correct, the Court of Appeals still committed error in imposing exemplary damages on the federal receiver for a failed national bank. Such damages are contrary to statute 12 U.S.C. 1825b, which says that the FDIC shall not be liable for any amount in the nature of a penalty. It's also contrary to the Supreme Court's holding, as recently recognized by the Fifth Circuit in the Claycomb case, which was submitted to this court, and the Supreme Court's holding as recognized by the Fifth Circuit in the Bank One versus Suzanne Taylor case. It's also violative of the federal common law, which does not allow the imposition of punitive or exemplary damages against an instrumentality of the United States. It's also contrary to Texas decisions and the public policy which is behind exemplary damages. 12 U.S.C. 1825b, which states that FDIC shall not be liable for the exemplary damages or any amounts in the nature of a penalty, is a clear and unambiguous statement that confers broad immunity on the FDIC. And where the plain language of a statute unmistakably communicates the intent of Congress, it should be regarded as conclusive. The FDIC was created to serve a public interest, and there would be no deterrent effect in imposing punitive or exemplary damages against the FDIC. Section 1825B is just a reflection of the federal common law, which has long recognized that point. It would only serve to punish the innocent creditors of the failed institution and would not have the intent behind exemplary damages.
Counsel, when was the defense that punitive damages cannot be assessed against the FDIC raised, and how does Dent's Noon cases
First of all, the defense was first raised in a motion for rehearing after exemplary damages were imposed by the Court of Appeals. This case was briefed to the Court of Appeals by the bank prior to its failure, and at the time that oral argument was heard by the Court of Appeals, The FDIC had recently been appointed receiver and appeared before the Court of Appeals. At the time, exemplary damages were then assessed against the FDIC. FDIC, in a motion for rehearing, raised at that time the law which would bar imposition of the punitive damages. The cases regarding the Dench Doctrine and other federal common law defenses commonly employed by the FDIC are entirely distinguishable from the case here. This court addressed those defenses in Larson and held that they can't be raised where an error-free judgment by a trial court has voided an asset, and the FDIC has taken no asset at all, and later through its Dench-Dumey defenses and the statutory defenses tries somehow to raise those defenses when it's taken no asset. More importantly here, this is distinguishable from the defenses that are raised under the Dench-Dumey Doctrine and similar federal common law defenses which have some element of proof. Here there can be no surprise to the Cockrells by the failure to have raised it at a point below. The law bars imposition of exemplary or punitive damages against the FDIC, and where the law would serve to, where the law establishes as a matter of law the defensive grounds necessary, the courts have recognized that it's not necessary to submit that issue. I would cite a Texas case, the City of El Paso versus Boyce Concessions at 772 Southwest 2nd, 291. The reason for this distinction is clear. As the federal cases that were cited indicate, the, in a sense, imposition of exemplary damages against an instrumentality is akin to a waiver of sovereign immunity for those damages and is an imposition that can't otherwise be made under federal common law. It's not necessary to make any element of proof as it is under the Dench-Dumey decisions and under 12 U.S.C. 1823E, where some nature of surprise might be, where some surprise might be brought against the party opposing the FDIC.
Now, in that regard, the FDIC was not a party in this case at the trial court level, was it?
That's correct, Your Honor. That was
and
still
so
the thing.
The punitive damages that you're talking about violate public policy by having them adjudged against an entity or part of the United States government. You really inherited that jury verdict, did you?
No, Your Honor. What we inherited was a judgment NOV which held that there was no probative evidence.
Would it have made a difference if there had been a judgment entered on the jury verdict instead of, as the Court of Appeals said, the trial court erring in not entering that judgment?
Your Honor, I don't believe that there would have been. There would still have been an appealable judgment. And as the Larson decision makes clear, the underlying trial court decision in Larson voided the asset, and the bank submitted a supersedious bond in that case, and the assessment against the failed bank was made against the bank, and the FDIC took no asset, which it could later resuscitate through its Dench-Dumey defenses.
So even under the law as you understand it and would urge our reaffirmation of it, even if the FDIC had come on the scene for the first time after a judgment for punitive damages for good cause had been entered by a trial court based on a jury verdict or based on a bench trial, the FDIC would bear no liability for that.
That's correct, Your Honor. Now, obviously that isn't the case here since that judgment was never entered, but that would be the law because the exemplary damages would be assessed against the FDIC, an entity serving the public interest. And
why would this be different from any other liability that they would inherit from the institution?
In part because of the nature of the exemplary damages.
It's what you have is a court judgment, and you inherit liabilities based on other court judgments, I assume. Why would this be different from any other court judgment imposing a liability on the institution that you would inherit from the institution? The liability was pre-existing FDIC's control or interest.
First of all, I'd like to reemphasize that that's not the case here, that judgment wasn't entered. But if that judgment had been entered and were an appealable judgment, that were not final. It would be distinguishable from the Larson judgment. And the FDIC, again, serving the public interest where the incidence of the exemplary damages would be against the creditors and, in essence, against the insurance fund itself. The FDIC shouldn't, as Congress has said, the FDIC should not be subject to punitive or exemplary damages like those where the incidence is against the innocent creditors and depositors of the institution. So the judgment would still be appealable, and in that case, the exemplary damages shouldn't lie against the federal receiver. That's the distinction between this case or the hypothetical case that you pose and the Larson case, which this court did decide. In that case, the judgment was an error-free judgment of the trial court that was entered prior to FDIC being a party to the action. The federal common law behind the Section 1825B is also very clear, and the public policy behind not imposing exemplary damages against a federal instrumentality, particularly one as here, where the innocent creditors of the institution and the deposit insurance fund will bear the burden rather than a party where exemplary damages could have some deterrent effect, that distinction should be noted by this court. In addition, even if the court examines the Larson case and doesn't find the distinction that I urge, the Larson case still makes clear that fundamental error should allow for an issue to be raised for the first time on appeal. And I would urge this court to find that fundamental error would occur if exemplary damages in contravention of an express statute and federal common law, if exemplary damages were entered against an instrumentality designed to serve the public interest.
Still having some difficulty. The exemplary damages judgment was not entered against the FDIC. It was entered against the banking institution, wasn't it?
No, Your Honor. At the time that while the Court of Appeals added the FDIC as receiver rather than substituting the FDIC as receiver, the bank no longer existed. There was no bank which could pay punitive damages. It had been placed in receivership, and only the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation existed.
It was a judgment NOV in the trial court, wasn't it?
The judgment NOV found that there were no punitive, there were no exemplary damages, and in fact were no damages at all.
It was for the bank and the trial court.
That's correct. The bank prevailed. That alone should be a distinction from the Larson case that would place a decision in this case, barring exemplary damages and allowing FDIC to raise this issue. It would place this court in accord with the federal cases that have examined it and which have allowed the FDIC, where it prevailed below, to raise its issues for the first time on appeal.
Your real argument is this is a type of immunity that doesn't have to be asserted or proved at any particular point in the proceedings, isn't that right?
That's one of my arguments, yes, Your Honor. I would still argue that the Larson case is distinguishable and addresses...
Well, assuming it's not.
Even if it is not, I would argue that that's correct, that under the Suzanne Taylor case, Bank One versus Suzanne Taylor, the recent Fifth Circuit decision, which I cited to this court, that the imposition of exemplary damages against the FDIC cannot stand, and that Congress has not expressly waived, has not expressly allowed the imposition of punitive damages, and thus they can't be assessed against the receiver.
What if this judgment had become final against the bank before the FDIC became receiver, so that it's merely a question of executing on a judgment?
We would argue, Your Honor, that under the Suzanne Taylor case and under 1825B and under this, the Texas decision of County of El Paso versus Boyce Concession, that the imposition of exemplary damages would still be improper and could not be made against FDIC as receiver. However, that case would certainly be factually more similar to the Larson case and is not the case that we have before us today. But we would argue that the imposition of exemplary damages would still be improper and would contravene federal common law and the express statute.
Any other questions? Did the FDIC have an opportunity to assert its defenses prior to submission of the case on oral argument in the Court of Appeals?
The FDIC did not appear in the case until the day of oral argument in this case, and it was submitted to the court that way. The FDIC had been appointed receiver in March, and I believe oral argument and submission occurred in May. However, as the statutes have recognized, FDIC, when it becomes receiver for a failed institution, does not immediately know all of the litigation. In fact, there's a 90-day stay provision to stay the state court litigation proceedings until the FDIC has had an opportunity to assess the existing cases which it has inherited from a failed institution.
Is that a self-executing stay provision? Stay provision? And does it apply to appeals?
We have not raised it here, and I don't believe it is self-executing. As a routine matter, the FDIC seeks at all costs to go before the state courts and attempt at that time to exercise the stay or have the court implement the stay in order to assess the litigation. I don't know why that didn't occur here.
I don't recall you raising that in your brief. Mentioning that in your brief. If it's in there, I just missed it.
No, Your Honor, it's not in the brief. It was solely in response to the question of whether we had raised it. As we did argue in the brief, we raised it at the first opportunity after the exemplary damages were imposed. As prior to that time, judgment NOB had been entered on behalf of the bank, and the bank inherited that, or the FDIC inherited that from the failed institution.
So you're saying that the FDIC did not come into possession of the lawsuits even though you had been appointed receiver?
No, Your Honor, that's not our position at all. We came into possession of those lawsuits and had to defend them as the receiver for the failed institution.
But you had a 90-day grace period.
We, under the statute, we had a 90-day grace period, which could have been, had we gone to the court and requested a stay under that statutory provision, we should have been entitled to that. Yes, Your Honor.
Would you submit a post-submission letter brief on this statute and what you think, how this statute implicates the appeal in response to questions that have been generated here this morning?
Yes, I'd be happy to, Your Honor.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May I please the court, Mr. S. Stewart Fraser will present argument for respondents.
Please, Honorable Supreme Court, Counsel. Your Honors, this court does not have to reach a decision as to the definition of possession, which would cause some absurd result, as suggested by counsel. The reason being that there were no objections or complaints filed by the bank during the trial of this case as to the definition and the questions that were submitted to the jury. When the case was tried, I tried the case and I requested that the court define the word possession. And I requested that the court define the word possession as exclusive control of the collateral. Counsel for the bank argued against that. And in fact, counsel for the bank stated, and I want to read you just a small portion of it here, stated to the court, it said, he said, Your Honor, in response, it's our position that the word, quote, possession, end quote, is a word of common usage and common understanding. It would be inappropriate for the court to define that word for the jury. We think, and also the term, quote, possession, end quote, is not defined by the Uniform Commercial Code. It's not defined, that I'm aware of, in a Texas case in this context. It's just a common word with a common and ordinary meaning. We think the court's charge is correct in that respect. So, even though I had asked the court for a definition of the word possession, I didn't get it. And the case was argued on the basis, and we argued it that way, that possession is just a common word of common ordinary meaning. And that's the way, that's what the jury knew about the word possession. And what was in the minds of the jury is something that none of us will ever know. The word possession as defined in their minds was whatever they thought it was, as we argued it to them. So The idea that possession even has to be defined in this case, I think, is an incorrect idea. That's not the way the case was tried. That's not the way the case was argued.
And so to that extent, you take issue with the Court of Appeals, the position of which was that possession should be defined, and it should be defined in the way that you argued in the trial court.
Well, Your Honor, in my view, that's dicta, and I don't think it's necessary for this court to get to that point. I think that they waived their right to argue the technical definition of the word possession, even though it's not defined in the Uniform Commercial Code. It is mentioned in many of the cases which counsel has cited to this court.
But if the Court of Appeals used that definition in analyzing the case, didn't they analyze it wrong? Shouldn't they have used the common ordinary definition on which the case was tried?
Your Honor, that's the position that I took in the trial court, that the word possession meant exclusive possession. And that's what I told the trial court. And the Court of Appeals agreed with that. But my point is that I don't think it's necessary for the Court of Appeals or this court to define the word possession in this case, because the bank waived that right when it failed to object to the charge and as submitted to the jury. However, if this court does feel that it has jurisdiction in this case and that that it does need to consider the definition of the word possession, and if this court does feel that it needs to consider whether or not the buyer of the equipment had possession as of the date of the contract, which was August 1, 1985, then there is an abundance of evidence that was admitted in the trial of the case and that was presented to the appellate court to show that the Sidnors did not gain possession of the collateral until October 3, 1985, when Mr. Cockrell delivered to the Sidnors the keys. There is a reason that Mr. Cockrell wanted to keep control of this business after the contract was made and after the August 1 signing of the contract. The reason was that Mr. Cockrell was obligated to suppliers that had supplied the little slats for the mini blinds and all the equipment for the mini blinds on jobs that he had sold prior to the contract date. The Court of Civil Appeals quoted Mr. Cockrell when Mr. Cockrell said on October the 3rd, there was a moment of great joy. And that moment of great joy was when the Sidnors paid $17,500 that they had collected for jobs that Mr. Cockrell had sold and had and was responsible for prior to the August 1 contract date. And on that moment of great joy, then, Mr. Cockrell returned the keys to the Sidnors. He took his two employees out of the business. He had those employees in there operating the slat machines, which were making the slats for the little mini blinds. And he removed his employees. He gave the keys back to them. And he gave them, he turned over control of the business. And Mr. Cockrell's office is located only three doors down on Olive Street in Dallas from the building where these little mini blinds were being manufactured. There was no delivery of the collateral in this case to anyone. Many of the cases which counsel has cited in his brief hinge on delivery of the collateral. In this case, there was no delivery. The collateral didn't go anywhere. It stayed right where it was. It was bolted to the floor in a little warehouse, and it stayed there. And there was no reason for any lendor or any possible buyer of that equipment to think somehow that that it was controlled, that the control of it was different after August 1 and prior to October 3rd. The sign on the front of the building didn't change. It stayed the same. to any observer, there was no change. So there was no delivery in this case. And I think that's an important distinction in the cases that were cited by the FDIC in its brief. Mr. Cockrell filed his UCC Form 1 on October 7, 1985, which was only 4 days after this moment of great joy that the Court of Civil Appeals described, when the Sidnors paid the $17,500, when Mr. Cockrell took his employees out of the business, out of the building, returned the keys, and they changed the locks. So there was an abundance of evidence that was presented to the trial court, that was before the jury, and the Court of Civil Appeals recognized that. The counsel for FDIC was asked whether or not the FDIC had an opportunity to make application for a stay. And the answer to that is yes, they did have that opportunity. This appeal was filed in October of 1987. The FDIC did not come in and take possession of the bank, was not appointed as receiver for the bank until the following spring, and that was in April. And this case was argued then to the Court of Civil Appeals several months later. And the first knowledge that we had that the FDIC was even involved was on the day that we appeared for the oral argument before the Fort Worth Court of Civil Appeals. We were handed a application for joinder by the FDIC. There was no argument made by the FDIC at the hearing, at the oral argument before the Court of Civil Appeals in Fort Worth. There was not any argument made that they were going to assert any federal defenses to the exemplary damages. They didn't do that until they filed their motion for rehearing, which I believe was some 8 months after they were appointed as receiver.
Question, why should they have raised it since the judgment in the trial court was favorable to them?
Well, they should have raised it at the oral argument because it would have given us notice as to how to respond to it. They should have raised it because there needs to be some certainty in the rules of procedure as well as some certainty in the federal banking system. The lawyers that try cases need to know what's going to happen if they don't make objections in the trial court, if they fail to make arguments in the Court of Civil Appeals, and if they fail to follow the rules. It is an important thing, I think, to our system of justice for the lawyers who are out in the trenches trying these cases to believe that that these rules mean something and will be enforced. I think that that this court has recently been involved in an effort to simplify the rules, and the idea that that the rules apply to some of us but don't apply to others of us is not a settling thing for people who are trying cases like I do. And I think that we need to have that certainty. Now, I understand that that the federal rules or the federal law has preempted a lot of our rules and allows bench-dummy defenses and takes away a lot of the common law actions that we would normally have in these cases. But I think, as I understand it, the reason for that is so the FDIC can look at the books of a failed financial institution and know what that financial institution is all about by looking at books rather than going to some oral thing that some bank officer might have done. That's not the case here. The FDIC knew well in advance about our case and about the potential liability in our case, and they knew well in advance when they sold these assets to some other bank, I think the Texas bank, about the potential liability in this case.
But there's no reason to object as long as you're winning, is there? It doesn't serve any of our purpose. I mean, it doesn't give the trial court an opportunity to correct a ruling if, in fact, up to that point, you're still the judge's ruling in your favor.
Well, Your Honor, are you speaking about the charge to the...
I'm sorry. Related to the exemplary damages, the FDIC aligned as it was with the bank had prevailed until the Court of Appeals rendered its judgment. And if there was, what reason could there have been for them to assert the stay, the 90-day stay period, and assert that the Court of Appeals, if in fact you rule against us, were immune from exemplary damages, when in fact up to that point, bank
had won? Your Honor, in my mind, I equate that to something like an affirmative defense, that you have to raise it at a certain point, and if you don't raise it, then you waive it. And you know, you can carry that on out and say, well, the FDIC then could come to this court and file in its motion for rehearing. If it lost here, its motion for rehearing, it could raise for the first time its federal defenses, and that just does not seem to be an orderly process to me, and it seems to me that there has to be some point in time when they waive these defenses which the federal government has so generously given to them. I think there has to be some orderly form of procedure that we can all know and understand and have confidence in as these cases move through the courts.
Counsel, would you address the Fifth Circuit case, the Suzanne Taylor case that the counsel mentioned?
Your Honor, I think that case was mentioned in the Larson case, which I submitted a supplemental brief on today, and there were a lot of questions asked counsel about that Larson case, and the distinction in Larson, of course, the FDIC or the financial institution lost and had judgment entered against it in the trial court. And in this case, is, as has been noted already, this case is distinguished from that in that judgment was favorable to the financial institution in the trial court. And it's my position that that judgment, that this case can be equated with the Larson case because judgment was entered against the FDIC in the Court of Civil Appeals in Fort Worth, and therefore I think it is analogous to the Larson case, and the same logic would apply. They did raise the issue for the first time in their motion for rehearing. But they certainly had an opportunity to raise it before judgment was entered against them. They didn't do it, and in my view, they waived their opportunity to.
Counsel, let me ask you several questions about the possession portion of the case. There was about a two-month overlap when you alleged that it really took the time to consummate this deal. What if that had been 2 or 3 years? Is that fair to a financial institution that's financing an ongoing business?
Is it fair to a financial institution?
Right. I mean, what if it had taken 2 years for the Sidners to collect enough money to pay and get Cockrell off the hook?
Your Honor, the contract did not speak to that. And I think that there would always be a subjective test there, and that there would always be a fact issue there. I think 2 or 3 years would not be reasonable. And I think that would be too long, and subjectively it would be my view that that it wouldn't work that way.
Can a court make that cut off? Or? jury always make it, or how the legal system can resolve that tension?
I believe that is a fact question, Your Honor, and I think that is one that the prior fact would always decide. I don't think that I agree with what counsel told the court, the trial court. I don't think there is a definition of possession in the Uniform Commercial Code, and the cases vary on it. But in this case, we don't really have to address that.
You say the two employees of Sidner remained back to work on making the mini buns. How many of Cockrell's employees were working there? In this August to October period.
Two employees of Cockrell were running the slat machine, mm-hmm. and then Cockrell had an accountant that also kept the accounting records.
Okay, all right. How many, I got the parts back. How many employees did Sidner have on the premises?
Your Honor, it's a small business, and I don't believe that is part of the record, but I think there were three or four employees there.
Can't you equate possession to control?
Your Honor, that's what the Court of Civil Appeals did, and that, in my view, that is a correct interpretation of it. I think in order to have possession, you have to have control.
Because that goes all the way back to Pearson v. Post. Remember, control of a wild animal?
Yes.
The title to a wild animal is determined by control.
Right. That's a lawsuit case, I believe. And yes, and I would certainly equate Pearson with this case, and control is important. And that is the definition that I had requested the trial court to use. Counsel for the bank objected to it. We didn't get that issue, so we tried it on the basis of just a common sense approach. And since we did that, I don't think that this court has to define possession, and I don't think there's a necessity to reach some sort of absurd result.
When do you, what is your position on when the FDIC was required to raise additional issues that it now argues in the court?
Well, Your Honor, I think that it should have raised it within a reasonable time after the FDIC took over the bank, certainly prior to the time that we made oral argument, so the matter could have been fleshed out in the Court of Civil Appeals. I believe that it would be absurd to say that the FDIC could raise that issue for the first time, say, on a motion for rehearing in the Supreme Court.
If they had raised these issues prior to oral submission in the Court of Appeals, would that have been sufficient to put them at issue?
According to my understanding of Larson, I believe it would, Your Honor.
Any other questions?
If the FDIC had not become the receiver for this bank until after oral argument in the Supreme Court, do you think, and we had ruled hypothetically against the bank at that point for the first time, do you think it would be unreasonable to say that they would be obligated to raise it only after judgment had been rendered against them?
I think that would be reasonable, yes. But here they did have the opportunity and they failed to do it.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thanks, Your Honors. Thank you.
I have just a couple of points on rebuttal, if I may. The tension that's involved in what would occur if this deal had finally closed 2 years after it initially was entered into is resolved by the transfer of physical control. That's the point at which the seller must record his priority, or within 20 days. The FDIC's predecessor, the bank, did object to the exclusivity requirement that was raised by Mr. Cockrell's counsel, And that exclusivity requirement was central to the Court of Appeals holding. That's the element upon which the Court of Appeals was able to find any probative evidence. The word possession, however, can't mean whatever the jury thought it was if the jury's conclusion isn't bolstered by some evidence of probative value. The UCC is intended generally to give common meaning to the words and to create clarity in the course of commercial conduct. And the finance company decision upon which we rely for the standard that transfer of physical control is transfer of possession recognizes that. That is the common general usage of the word and is the meaning which the UCC intended to give the word possession. Moreover, there are cases that have discussed the word possession in its common and general usage and determined what that means, transfer of physical control.
So I understand that there was no definition submitted to the jury of the term possession, that the only definition that was preferred by opposing counsel. That was objected to. The objection was sustained. No definition was submitted. Do you really have a point on that definition?
Pardon me?
Do you have a point on that definition, that the absence of a definition at this point? It's an evidentiary point, but it's one that if there's evidence to support the common usage made by the jury.
That's we don't have a point of error on the submission to the jury without a definition of the word possession, but we do have a point that the Court of Appeals relied on an improper definition with the exclusivity requirement in order to find any probative evidence at all. All of the evidence went to the transfer of possession occurring on August 1st, save the 3 points that were raised by Mr. Cockrell, which go only to exclusivity, to retaining some control that made it less than exclusive, but it doesn't go to the transfer of possession to the Sidnors on August 1st. Mr. Cockrell did want to keep control. But he argues that there was no delivery and thus there was no transfer of possession. I would just point the court to August 1st being the date at which the Sidnors got the lease. There was delivery on the day that the Sidnors became the leaseholders. It was their warehouse. And Mr. Cockrell was no longer free to exercise control over the equipment. Just because he retained keys and had an office 3 doors down does not mean that he retained any possessory interest.
Were those his employees or... Their employees that were operating the machinery.
The record indicates that the operation of the business was by the Sidnors from August 1st on, but that Mr. Cockrell had 2 employees that remained on the premises during the operation by the Sidnors. It isn't clear whether they were there full time or not, but they were on the premises during that 2-month period from the time that the Sidnors began operating the business on August 1st.
Any other questions? Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
That concludes the argument in the first cause. The court will now take a brief recess.
The audience will please rise.